Tonight on Arena, Rhiannon Giddens on the Your Roots Are Showing Festival and Conference, and Edith Hall on the enduring power and relevance of the Greek classics. #51551 is the text, and you can get us on socials at RTE Arena. Rhiannon Giddens is a two-time Grammy-winning singer, multi-instrumentalist and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. Giddens has also earned a Pulitzer Prize for her work as a composer and storyteller. Through her music, she has become a leading voice in reclaiming overlooked stories and challenging historical perspectives, particularly within American roots music. She has also done much for the banjo, bringing it into the world of opera and into the music of Beyoncé. Currently nominated for a Grammy for her rendition of Alice Randall's The Ballad of Sally Ann, Giddens balances her career with roles as artistic director of the Silk Road Ensemble, podcast host and author. She will be part of a new festival in Kerry, the Folk and Fusion Festival, which will bring together some of the most revered names in folk and roots music, as that name suggests. But it also includes a conference whose name I love, I must say, Your Roots Are Showing. And Rhiannon will be giving the keynote address at that particular section of the festival. We'll talk to Rhiannon shortly. But first of all, let's hear that Grammy-nominated song, The Ballad of Sally Ann.
Shivered as she said, I'll love you till the day I'm dead. Johnny got married in his one good suit, but the ride from the church it bore strange fruit. Down by the road you can hear her cries, he hung from a tree, she watched him die.
Rhiannon Giddens there with her wonderful version of The Ballad of Sally Ann, the song that is currently Grammy nominated. And delighted to have Rhiannon join us on the programme this evening. It's an extraordinary story, The Ballad of Sally Ann, Rhiannon, because you're listening, oh, this is very happy. Little bit of gentle banjo plucking at the beginning and everything's going great. And then we hear Strange Fruit, and then we hear what happens to them on their way to the wedding. It's so dark when it gets going.
It is. It's a really dark song, but it's meant to be. You know, It's by Alice Randall, and she's a, you know, African-American songwriter who's been living in Nashville for years, writing songs for Black women to sing that no one was letting Black women sing back when she was writing them. You know what I mean? So, you know, like folks like Mark O'Connor and other lovely musicians, you know, would cover her songs, but like she never heard them sung like she had written them. So this is obviously a song about lynching that was done sort of in this up-tempo sort of bluegrass style, like back in the day when it was originally recorded. And so this is part of a larger project that she was able to put together, having, you know, Black female singers do her songs. And I just want to mention, you know, that was recorded, my side of that track was recorded here in Ireland with my longtime colleagues, Francesco Teresi and Ben Rollins. And then it was produced, you know, there's other stuff produced on it by Ebony Smith in Nashville. So it was a real kind of bi-country experience. But like, you know, there's a lot of good stuff happening here in Ireland. I always like to put that plug in.
Yeah, well, thanks for mentioning it. And it's in some ways that song for me links into this wonderful festival and conference that you're involved in, Your Roots Are Showing, because Your Roots Are Showing, it's a kind of a two-sided statement, isn't it? When we think of that ballad that we've just heard and you're talking about Olive Randall not hearing it the way she wanted to hear it, because Your Roots Are Showing isn't always a compliment, but I think what you would believe is let your roots show, let them get out there, let them be seen.
I think so. I think that's where we're at right now. You know, there's been so many mythologies told about it. Well, I can speak specifically about American music because that's my thing. There's been so much mythology, you know, made up about American music that has really covered up you know, a lot of the original roots of where it comes from. And that happens actually in a lot of different places. Wherever you have nationalism, you have mythology making. And that usually means that the folks, some of the folks who were originally there at the beginning of the story don't get talked about. And that's certainly been the case with, you know, say country music, old time music, bluegrass music in terms of, you know, African American co-creation and involvement. And I think, you know, having a conference named that, I think is really important because it talks about, you know, what is traditionalism? What is, you know, what is folk music? What are we calling it? Because it's not just about what we play, you know, it's also about how we talk about it and what we're bringing to it. And I think it's really important to create a space for that.
It also struck me in terms of Olive Randell and that kind of, as you say, upbeat bluegrass style that is there across this incredibly dark story. Was that in some ways, and I know this is done across pop music even today, you get sad songs that are upbeat, but was that a way of potentially masking the roots rather than hiding them, if you know what I mean? That you were saying, yeah, this is a dark song, but some people will just hear the upbeat music and they'll clap along with it. They won't even listen to the words.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I will just say it's Alice
Sorry,
Randell.
beg your pardon, Alice Randell.
Yeah, it's okay. I think that's part of the style. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, it's the same. It's kind of a hallmark of old time music and bluegrass music is, you know, these really serious things that you kind of hear. Like you get halfway through the song and you're like, wait a minute, you know, it is part of the style, but also Alice, you know, used the tools that she was given. So like whoever was going to cover her song at that point, it wasn't who she wrote it for, but she wanted the song to get out there. And then now years later, you know, it's already been out there so that it can be covered by somebody like me. You know, you do what's in front of you. You use the tools that you're given. And I think that getting a story out there in whichever way that you are able to is part of what folk music does as well. You know, it's like I don't think you should have to do that, but if it works in a lot of different ways, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, so I took it and I made it much darker and I kind of rewrote the melody a little bit and because it was kind of a traditional melody. And it's still a banjo, but it's my banjo. It's a replica from 1858, and it's the deeper, darker, you know, soulful version of that original recording, however many years ago. So it's, you know, I think it works in its own way. Sometimes you want it to be a little lighter so that the punch of it hits you in a certain way, but also sometimes you just want to say, this is a freaking sad song. You know, here we go.
Mind you, you talk about your banjo. Your banjo is quite the instrument, and what you've done for the instrument. And I've said this, I suppose, your banjo almost metaphorically. You have taken that instrument, possibly one that was scoffed at, possibly one that was derided for a long period of time, and you've brought it into the mainstream, even into opera.
You know, I'm still kind of stunned at what I've been given opportunities to do. It's my banjo has been, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2, one of the biggest selling video games, you know, ever. It's on that soundtrack. It's on a Beyonce song. I wrote an opera on it. You know, it's been kind of everywhere, and people don't even know it's me. You know what I mean? But they've heard that sound, and that to me is the best thing ever. I've never, you know, been into this for celebrity or for putting myself anywhere, but if I can get that banjo, you know, the banjo, as you said, has been so maligned. It's been so turned into a sort of a comedy instrument, but the roots of it are so deep and they're so spiritual. And obviously it's an African derived instrument. And I just feel like I've just taken every opportunity I can to just slide that sound in there, you know, so people don't even know it's a banjo sometimes at first. And they go, oh wow, that's the banjo I can get behind. You know what I mean? So it's been I've just been really fortunate, and I've just tried to do as much as I can to get it where people don't expect it.
And as you say, you know, bringing it into a Beyoncé song, bringing it into opera, bringing the banjo into that kind of mainstream and into that high art end of things, that is rehabilitation the right word?
I mean, I think there's me and a bunch of us. There's a banjo crew, folks who've been trying to rehabilitate the banjo, to reclaim the banjo, to show people the real history of it, you know, because it has been so mythologized and so sort of one-dimensionalized. And it's not just me. I'm just one of many. But I think it's been really important because it is really one of the true American instruments. You know, if you think about America as a nation state, it's like it is Africa meets Europe, Like, absolutely. It is, I think, a true representation of what so much of American music is, and it just represents it in itself. And I think that that's a really powerful emblem, and it needs to be taken as a serious emblem. Obviously, it can be a lot of fun, but it has to be at its core, taken seriously, because it really represents a lot of really tough history.
Can you give a keynote address without having your banjo in your back pocket, as it were, or at least strapped around your shoulder? Because it illustrates so much as you the way you play it.
I mean, I don't, I haven't done very many keynotes without playing music, so I doubt that I'll be doing this one without my banjo, because as you say, a song is better than 20 minutes of words. You know what I mean? So I do tend to like to set it up and then put the bowling ball down the lane with the banjo and just go, you can either listen to what I've just said or you can just hear the song, so.
Make your choice. Your most recent album and podcast, American Railroad, with the Silk Road Ensemble, of which you're now artistic director. Again, you're exploring untold story histories here. And I was listening to the first episode of the podcast today, and just as you lay it out, it's like, of course, how can you tell the history of America or the story of America without mentioning the building of the railroads? It's how the land was opened up. Some would say maybe destroyed in certain places, but certainly it was about how that country grew in the 19th into the 20th century.
Absolutely. I mean, the railroad really is, you can explore so many different aspects of American history just through that one thing, because it does show so much. I mean, there are so many parallel histories happening. You have, the connection of the two coasts, and therefore the economic explosion that then happened in the nation state of America. You have the destruction of so much native culture, the confiscation of lands, the destruction of the buffalo, the moving of tribes. You have the exploitation of Irish workers, of African American workers, of Chinese workers, of basically the underclass of America. So you have all of that going on at once, but what we usually get told is just the top layer, the economic boom, right? But who pays for this? And so the Silk Road having multiple people from some of those groups, in represented in the ensemble, I just thought, well, we have to do this. So we've been doing concerts. We've, now ha does have done this podcast, which is amazing. And it's just this opportunity to keep telling these stories that are not the ones that we're getting in school, but most of the people who are in the school are the folks who are descended from those most affected by, the building of the railroad, in terms of not getting that money, but getting that having that labor or that destruction happen to their culture. So I think it's been a really amazing opportunity. And we've had some great partners in that.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it is, if you think about the mix of immigrant communities that were working on those railways and really working in very difficult situations. I mean, labour law was not even an item at this point in time. Any kind of treatment of the employees was, I don't know how one could describe it. But the mix of immigrants and the mix of music that must have made and had in those encampments as they made their way across the country. How has that fed into, do you think, the music of America, first of all? And to what extent is the story of the railways only audible and only told in the music that was written by those immigrant communities?
I mean, there's so much that we'll never know. And this is the problem with poverty, is that poor people don't get written down. You know what I mean? They don't often get recorded. We're only lucky that the WPA works and like the Lomaxes of the world, bother to record a fraction, right, of what these people were doing. But you have to think there's a million different meetings of people along the way. And of course there were fights, and of course there were arguments, but there were also marriages, and there were music, and there were songs. And so something like the Silk Road Ensemble, it's like you take this very difficult history, because it is difficult history. People died, they were treated terribly, but then you take that and you use it as a springboard to, but what beauty came out of that? What can we create in this day and age, thinking about how we come together as humans, and how American music, and really American music is world music. So how all of our music has come from people coming together, whether they were forced out of somewhere else or whether they were, working next to them in a chain gang, whatever, we come together. And the thing as musicians is that we have to take that moment of beauty and then create from that. And that's what the Silk Road has been doing with this project. And you have Maeve Gilchrist, who's Irish Scottish harpist, next to Wu Man, who's this Chinese peepa player, next to Kaoru Watanabe, who's on Japanese taiko, next to myself on the banjo, next, you know what I mean? It's just, and then you see that that is how we solve anything, because you know the way that you play music with somebody else who comes from a different culture is that you listen louder than you speak, you know, you listen louder than you play, and then you actually can do something together. And that really is a metaphor for this crazy mixed up, you know, crazy world, you know.
I will come back to that because I want to finish up with a piece of music from American Railroad. But before I do that, your own festival, Biscuits and Banjos. Now, what do I get? I'm guessing I get some banjo. What kind of biscuits do I get if I go to, if I manage to be in your home state of North Carolina to be part of that festival?
Okay, this is so funny because it's been like this ongoing argument with people on my Facebook, because obviously I live in Ireland, I'm from North Carolina, and so whenever I post a picture of biscuits, I had during the lockdown, I taught myself how to make biscuit, American biscuits, right? American biscuits are like savory scones. They're kind of like, you know, they're different. I could tell you all the ways that a biscuit is different from a scone, but it's basically you don't put bacon on a sugar scone. You know what I mean? You can put bacon on a biscuit, or you can put jam on a biscuit. So it's in this kind of liminal space of, you know, savory or sweet, right? Which scones kind of make a decision one way or the other. So it's like every time I would post a picture of scones, people, or a picture of biscuits, people are like, oh, those are scones. And I'd be like, no, they're biscuits, and here's why. And then I had to teach myself why. Anyway, I got into this whole thing and I just thought, we need a festival. You know, I know there's people doing all this great work in food ways, especially in African American food ways, because that's obviously what I'm looking at specifically, looking at how to reclaim our historical creation of American food ways, and you know, what's happening with documentaries and books, and people are doing all these things. I'm like, they're doing the same thing that we're doing in the music world. So it would be great to have a festival that just celebrates this cultural, you know, this cultural exploration within the African American, like non-mainstream, you know, this is not R&B, this is not hip hop, this is not, you know, soul food necessarily. This is like people who are really digging into the historical roots of some of these things that people haven't really seen as black, but have actually been part of African American culture since the beginning. So that's what it is. I'm excited about it. It's going to be fun.
I'm glad, yeah. I mean, you couldn't call it the Savory Scones and Banjos Festival. It
No, definitely
wouldn't
not.
work, would it? Let's be honest. Let's finish up with as I said, something from the album American Railroad. And in that first episode that I mentioned of the podcast, we hear the voice of James William Love, I think singing Swannanoa, the song we're about to hear. It has a couple of titles, if I'm right in thinking that. But you have this version on the album, and it picks up on what he does in it, because it you might explain what the Swannanoa Tunnel was and what the booms that we hear within the music represent as we listen.
So Swannanoa Tunnel, also called Asheville Junction, is one of these songs that represents what, you know, what happens so often in America. It started off as an African American work song, and Love, William Love, sings it in that way. You can hear the booms of the pickaxes. He's hitting the table, you know, and you hear it as a work song. But that had been forgotten, you know, by the time somebody like me comes along. It's been a bluegrass standard for many years, and these two researchers from Western North Carolina discovered this, and I discovered their research, and then wanted to make it a part of this project, because it's about these African American convict laborers who were killed when the tunnel that they were building for the railroad through Western North Carolina collapsed on them. And this was just one of many, you know, accidents that happened in the building of the railroads, but it was immortalized in the song. And so the thing that was the weirdest and most kind of like shaking thing about this is that we had this as the lead single for this record that came out this year. And 2 days, you know, after the huge hurricane that then flooded and destroyed so much of Western North Carolina, Swannanoa got devastated. And 2 days after that, we were scheduled to put the song out. And it was just so intense. We did it any we let it go, we let it out, obviously, and then we put all these links to how to help Western North Carolina flood relief. But it was just like, I don't know. It was just really intense spiritual connection, thinking of the disaster that happened that inspired the song, and then the disaster that had just happened in Swannanoa, you know, and then you hear that pain in a totally different way when you hear the song after that had happened. So it was just a really intense experience.
Yeah, for sure. That gives a whole new context to the song I listened to this afternoon, not knowing that particular detail. Rhiannon Giddens, beautiful, and as always, great to speak with you, and thanks so much for being with us. Good luck with the festival. Your roots are showing. I'll give people the details out afterwards, but let's finish up by listening to Swannanoa or Asheville Junction with Rhiannon Giddens. Thanks, Rhiannon.
Thank you.
Asheville Junction, Swannanoa Tunnel, all caved in, babe, all caved in. Last December, I remember, wind blow cold, babe, wind blow cold. When you hear my watchdog howling, somebody's round, babe, somebody's round. When you hear that hoot owl squalling, somebody died, babe, somebody died. Hammer falling from my shoulder all day long, babe, all day long. I'm going back to Swannanoa Tunnel. That's my home, babe. That's my
off it goes, displaying some of the many ethnic instruments involved in the Silk Road Ensemble. That is Swannanoa or Asheville Junction, as sung by Rhiannon Giddens and the Silk Road Ensemble. Thanks indeed to Rhiannon for speaking to us. You can catch her at the first annual Folk and Fusion Festival as just part of Ireland's Folk Conference. Your Roots Are Showing, live at Gleneagle INEC Arena in Killarney on the 14th of January. Rhiannon will also be giving a keynote speech on Saturday, January the 18th. Full details on showingroots.com. And I must agree with the texter. We watched Rhiannon on the Xmas Christmas Eve RTE programme. She sang the Cherry Tree Carol. It was really incredible. Thank you, Rhiannon. Keep singing. We need you. We do indeed need people like Rhiannon Giddens. We are inclined, for understandable reasons, to look to modern behaviour and modern high-tech innovations for the chief causes of the 21st century climate crisis. Perhaps to see the Industrial Revolution from the mid-18th century onwards as a turning point in our treatment of the natural world. But in her latest book, Epic of the Earth, Edith Hall traces the roots of this climate crisis in Homer's great epic, the Iliad, and suggests valuable lessons might be learned from how the Mycenaean culture collapsed some 3,000 years ago. Edith Hall is a professor in the Department of Classics and Ancient History at Durham University, and she is the author of more than 30 books. She's also a guest at the Classics Now Festival in Dublin, which runs this year from January the 31st to February the 2nd. And delighted that Professor Edith Hall joins us now on the line. Very welcome to Arena, Edith. And you describe yourself on your website as someone who specialises in putting pleasure into the history, literature, theatre, myth and philosophy of ancient Greece and Rome and their continuing impact in the modern world. Were they always full of pleasure? History, literature, theatre, myth and philosophy. Were they always full of pleasure for you, even when you were being made to learn them at school, perhaps?
Well, not all of them. I much prefer the Greeks to the Romans, but I put that there because I don't think education has any point to it if people don't enjoy it, you know. Yeah. So that's really there to get people to believe that they can have fun as well as get informed when they're reading about the ancient Greeks.
And I know that that is one thing that you've been very keen in your role in Durham, in broadening out how the classics can be taught in second level schools and maybe even in late primary as well, and that they can open young children's minds up in a way that possibly our adult minds are closed.
It's not just that. I'm right now, my latest thing is I've started a program to get it into His Majesty's prisons. I'm teaching in prison a lot at the moment.
That's a very interesting side to it as well. It would seem then that whatever you want to find in the classics is there to be found if you look hard enough or if you read it in a specific way. Is that what you found when it came to the writing of the Epic of the Earth, which I must say does sound rather more sober than putting pleasure into things?
Yeah, well, it is sober. No, I've always, since I first read it 40 years ago, the Iliad, been amazed by the sheer number of trees that get chopped down in the course of this poem. And it's a great, it's a great colonial poem. It's about these Greeks going over to the Anatolia, to the great landmass, just Turkey, and just denuding it of forests and cutting down trees and consuming vast amounts of cattle, and particularly its bronze. I think that the Bronze Age is when the Anthropocene really started to kick in. The amount of timber that you need to chop down to forge a single spear or a single shield means you get locked in an endless cycle of having to colonize more and more lands, to cut down more trees, to make the weapons, to cut down more trees, to go and colonize more lands. That's when the Anthropocene started for me. It was the invention of blacksmiths.
So in fact, it didn't take the human beings, long to start to mess things up effectively.
No, not at all. I mean, if you really think about it, you cannot have mass warfare and mass imperialism without metal. I mean, there's only so far you can go with bows and arrows and pea shooters. It's the origins of war started when people invented the making of bronze. And the word bronze occurs in the Iliad, or words like bronzen or bronze-beaked or whatever, about, you know, 800 times. It's the epic of overconsumption, and it's the epic of wrecking territory in order to extend your empire. So it is very bleak, but it's also unbelievably grand. What Homer managed to do was make this sound glorious and beautiful and thrilling. Yeah. And that is what I'm trying to unpick, is that it this poem glorifies a certain kind of wild overconsumption, and we've been imitating that in our art ever since.
And not only, you know, yes, that overconsumption is there, but also the heroic male, you know, the great hero. This is about the Trojan Wars and the spoils of war, effectively.
Exactly.
You know, and it's about that male need to own, to possess. It's a kind
acquire.
Of a rampant kind of consumerism, a rampant type of capitalism.
It is. So, you know, when you get a prize for something, you get, you know, 200 tripods. What man needs more than one tripod to do his cooking on? You know, you get 50 beautiful women from Lesbos. How many women can one man sleep with in a night? You know, you get a hecatomb of cattle. How many men can eat 100 roast cows in a night? And it's kind of gets bigger and bigger and worse and worse. And when they build the fire for Patroclus, the great climax that, you know, Achilles made, you know, they go and chop down trees on Mount Ida for 12 days and nights. And you know what? The fir tree of Mount Ida is now a really endangered tree. You know, it's been hacked down. It's the only place in the world where that particular subspecies of pine grows. And that all started way back there. And I don't think, I wish I was a creative artist. I'd like to write an Iliad from the point of view of the last tree standing, watching Odysseus inventing the idea of the wooden horse and coming to get me with his axe.
I love the idea. Don't be putting yourself down as not a creative artist. You've already got the idea in your head. Sit down and write it now. You're going to get somebody else, are you?
Well, no, I'm going to tell my mate Marina Carr, who's a good friend of mine.
Oh, yes.
That I want to play from the point of view of the tree.
Yeah, well, that's no better woman than Marina Carr to give you just that. I suppose one of the issues, or one of the points rather than an issue, Edith, about the Iliad, indeed about many of these Greek myths that we speak about, we think of them as written texts, but of course they were they were stories that were told around fires or in dwellings and in high and low society. And so often story is all about explaining to ourselves what we are doing.
Absolutely. I mean, they've had magnificent records, but they did get written down. What we've got was written down in the 8th or 7th century BC. But it had gone through a process of at least 500 years of oral development. And this is something that Irish audiences, I think, can really relate to, is these grand old epic tales that were passed down through the oral tradition, were elaborated by bards. You know, it's a collective thing. There is no one Homer. You know, there may have been a guy who wrote it down and perfected it, but he was inheriting a 500-year tradition of epic storytelling. And that is in itself incredibly exciting, and it's one of the reasons everybody loves it. But what I'm trying to say is that if you actually start unpeeling all the layers, we can still enjoy it, we can read it and recite it, and we can make it into movies, and we can, make it into theatre. But I want to give it this added new perspective. People have been looking at it from like feminist points of view and, class points of view, and in fact, colonial points of view for a long time. I just want to add one more up-to-date resonance to it all so that we can really start thinking about how these guys abused nature and then relating it to how we do.
You go through some of the various sections of the Iliad that have been interpreted in different ways by different people. Two that particularly important, well, I suppose from an Irish point of view, Michael Longley, we'll come to that shortly.
Yeah.
But Simone Weil, you might explain, you see that as that essay in 1939 almost as a kind of a presage for the of what was to come in the 40s.
It is. She's got this amazing essay she wrote called The Iliad or the Poem of Force in 1939. So here's this, Jewish woman who is just got this incredible prescience about what the Holocaust and what the obliteration of all the great cities of Europe is going to do. And she goes through the whole thing showing the glorification of martial violence, and it was a real turning point. And people had started to look at the Iliad like that earlier, especially the First World War poets, that, actually it's not so glorious, this siege warfare. But it was that essay that proved the real turning point. Now, she saw it as people weren't worried in 1939 about, the actual end of nature, the end of organic life on Earth. But I am, and I've dedicated it to my children who are in their 20s and the rest of Generation Z, as they call themselves, with apologies for the state of the planet. I had no idea till 10 years ago. Most of us didn't. It's only about 10 years since the really desperate statistics have been coming in. And my kids are even talking about, not having children because they're so worried about the future.
I know, it is. It's quite disturbing when you hear that coming from the younger generation. And Michael Longley, then, how did his interpretation or his use of the Iliad strike you?
Well, I think it's incredibly beautiful. I mean, his poem "Cease Fire" is incredibly important in terms of reimagining Trojans versus Greeks as both British versus Irish and, North versus South. Yeah. Incredibly profound. I mean, I sometimes think that Michael Longley, it's been slightly in the shadow of Seamus Heaney, and I actually find his use of the classics absolutely as enthralling.
It was written at the time of the IRA 1994 ceasefire, and as you say, it does really make you think about things. One of the other things, you've written so many books about the classics, I can't touch on all of them, but one that really struck me was how you have used the classics within your own personal life and different personal traumas that you and previous generations of your family went through, how you have used the classics to explain that to your to yourself and to find a way through it, perhaps. Facing Down the Furies, Suicide, the Greeks, the Ancient Greeks and Me. Tell me about how you applied applied ancient Greek philosophy to that family history of yours.
Well, that was a very long, I realised that had been long in evolution. In fact, I realised because, you know, my family had one of these suicidal curses down my mother's line where generation after generation killed themselves and affected the next generation with depression and misery and fear that people would do that. And I didn't really, my mother would not speak about her, and I wasn't able till she died in 2016 to really go out and research that family. And they're all lowland Scots and terribly miserable and living in Dunbar and Glasgow and across the south of Scotland. And I then realised that I'd spent the last 40 years obsessed with Greek tragedy with its family curses, and also obsessed with the philosophy of Aristotle, who has some remarkable things to say about suicide, far more helpful to me than any Christian taboo, right? You know, I found the ancient Greek secular approach to it is much more practical, incredibly helpful. So I suddenly realised what I'd been doing with my whole life was actually autobiographically sort of motivated.
It's incredible that it provided you with that. Finally, to end on perhaps a more hopeful note, although that is a very hopeful note in that it helped you deal with that family.
It did. It was redemptive.
In the case of the Iliad and the case of the climate crisis, please tell me there's some, even just a little smidgen of a line that might give us some hope for the generations to come and for this planet in the years ahead.
Okay, well, there's this great simile, which is about how a man who does his water course through his garden, he thinks he can irrigate his orchards, but he doesn't understand the power of the water and it starts to submerge, it runs away with him. And that simile, to me, is incredibly instructive. It means that we've got to figure out how to make water courses through our gardens that don't run away with us. We've got to do it with the water flow, not against the water flow. It to me, that simile sums up the entire message of the poem, that if we're not extremely respectful and careful of what we do, we will be submerged.
We don't own the resources. They provide us with things. It's the other way around, really,
yes,
isn't it?
There's a lesson in there. We take it as a lesson, not as terror.
Yeah, absolutely. Lovely to speak to you this evening, Edith. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I look forward to being in Dublin in a couple of weeks.
Yes, I'll give people all the details of that now. That's Edith Hall, Epic of the Earth, reading Homer's Iliad in the fight for a dying world, will be published by the Yale University Press in the spring. Edith Hall will be appearing, as she mentioned there, at this year's Classics Now Festival in Dublin from January the 31st through until February the 2nd. She's taking part in an event called Reading Myths at 6:30 p.m. on Saturday, February the 1st. That's at the City Assembly House, and you'll find out full details on that on classicsnow.ie. The deep-seated nature of trauma is the subject of a hard-hitting new short film from artists Catherine O'Halloran and Grace Dias, screening next week in Limerick as part of the First Fortnight Festival. The film is called The No Show, and it charts the struggles faced by men in the city going back generations. Instead of asking, why didn't this person show up for himself or his family, the film encourages viewers to be curious about what happened to them, who didn't show up for them, and what made them the way that they are. I'm delighted to be joined by artists Catherine O'Halloran and Grace Dias from our studio in Limerick on this Tuesday evening. If I start with that term, no show, Grace, you're not from Limerick, but you've been spending time in Limerick and you kept hearing this expression, no show.
Hey, Sean. Yeah, it was just, you know, when you're not from a particular place and it's kind of like they have an O'Connell Street, but it's different to the O'Connell Street in Dublin, and you're kind of walking around. I just, one day I kept hearing people saying it over and over again, and I had to just take my notebook out and write it down.
And did you go exploring at that point? Or maybe we bring Catherine in at this stage. Was it a term that you thought was a particularly Limerick term, Catherine?
Yeah, well, I suppose I would be pretty versed in working with the no-shows of Limerick. So I have not only heard that expression used very commonly for people who don't turn up in various capacities, but also, you know, the various meanings that it can have. And so me and Grace just had a conversation around, you know, what does that actually mean? Mm. And what do people kind of presume from that? Yeah. What do they take from that? And do they ever really ask why?
Yeah. And it also struck me that it was this idea of, yes, okay, people don't show up, but who didn't show up for these people at various points in their lives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suppose that's the piece really that we wanted to dig into, because I suppose our goal was that people would ask that particular question, or at least kind of be left with some curiosity around, you know, people's ability to engage.
Yeah.
And even if they're physically there, sometimes they're not there in their full capacity. So I think trauma can do that to us. And so we felt like that was a thread that was worth pulling on, and that was as interesting to both of us.
Yes.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit, Grace, if you would, about the Limerick City Build, the organisation. I think Catherine had been involved with Limerick City Build for some time, and you came into that involvement. What sort of people did you meet there? What sort of stories were you hearing?
Yeah, so I'll let Catherine maybe explain a little bit more about Limerick City Build, as she is the founder of it. And I just have been in awe of their work for the last, I suppose, maybe 10 years. I've been kind of working, making art in Limerick communities. So when I was kind of working in my Ross or working in different places, I would have always been touching in with Limerick City Build. And what I think is amazing about it is, you know, there's a lot of projects out there for people who can't show up, who can kind of learn how to make a birdhouse and various different things like that. And Limerick City Build, like, does amazing work in the sense that, like, they teach all the construction trades and about building someone up, but as well as that, they do kind of therapeutic work alongside it. So I thought that was a really fascinating space to make a kind of a film. And trauma, Cab will probably speak in more detail to this, but one of the key things about it is that its ethos is trauma informed. And that's, I've worked in a lot of kind of community context projects as an artist, but I've never seen it so ingrained, and the expertise of the trauma-informed approach that Catherine and the team kind of take. And so when I was working there on this project, I kind of was, it was made possible by the Artists in the Community scheme and CREATE, which, like, something like this could never happen without that scheme. Yeah. It's amazing. And now obviously it'll be shown with the support of First Fortnight, which is incredible as well. An unprecedented level of support. But yeah, so the stories, I suppose, I guess we were sitting in the group, and what comes to mind is, like, we were talking to the group about our concept for this film, and very soon kind of the group started to unpack that. To understand them, they'd need to understand their own fathers, and to understand their fathers, they need to understand their grandfathers. And that led to us actually taking an approach with this film that's quite epic, in that it looks at generational trauma. So we go all the way back to the famine. And then we move into the kind of the 1930s, the poverty in Limerick, the 1950s, the control of the church and schools, and what impact that had on all of our fathers, I guess. It's that kind of working class trauma origin story, I suppose.
And Catherine, one of the important aspects of what you're doing in the No Show is that this is a story told entirely from the male perspective.
Yeah, and people are surprised by that, which is really interesting. And I suppose I'm very embedded in, you know, the male perspective on a day-to-day basis. And I suppose it's very, very different than, you know, the female perspective when we are looking at trauma. you know, how men process trauma, how they're impacted neurologically by trauma, and how their behaviour then manifests as a result of trauma. And I suppose all we tend to see, you know, in terms of society, is the consequences of that, which can be quite volatile, aggressive, and often result in people committing crimes, in addiction, and you know, being quite adversarial. And I suppose my work is really about, you know, asking not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you, and not just using that as a cliche, but really, really doing an investigative kind of process relationally with the young people around that.
Yeah. And one of the things that you do is we get several Patricks or several Paddies, really, mm-hmm. different individuals who we follow. But effectively, it's the story of, if you like, it's almost like the story of one man or the story of malehood. Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip from early on. This is the narrator, Ray O'Halloran, from early on in the film, explaining possibly who Patrick or the Patricks are.
That was Patrick getting ready to meet the date. He doesn't even know what day it is. He doesn't care what day it is. He doesn't even know we're here. He's not where he's supposed to be. He never is. This would be the part in the film where you hear a voice that makes you wonder, will he get there or not? I don't want you to care about any of that. The story is bigger than all of that. I won't say too much. I don't have to. You'll know what I mean. I've been there. I'll always be here in the background, except when I'm not.
I love that line, I'll be here except when I'm not. Yeah. Ray O'Halloran in the an opening part of the film The Nose Show. Catherine O'Halloran and Grace Dias speaking to me about it this evening. Briefly, Grace, just to finish up, there are a number of professional actors, but I think a lot of the participants in the film are actually those who are involved in the Limerick City Build organisation.
Yep, yeah, that's right. It's an interesting thing, Sean, I guess, this talk of like who are actors and who are first-time actors and all of that. And I think for me, I always look at it as someone who is an undiscovered actor, someone who hasn't had the opportunity to be an actor, that wasn't given to them or wasn't seen as something that they could do.
Yeah.
So oftentimes in the work I do, I end up just going into organisations or going into different communities and you just spot who is talented and who is an actor but just hasn't been able to find their way there. And in this film, there's so many people that I really want to champion now going forward, you know, like that I'm just like, oh, I think, I won't say who, but there's one of the people in it who I think might be my new favourite actor even Daniel Day-Lewis.
Beyond Daniel Day-Lewis, no small praise. Thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. That's Catherine O'Halloran and Grace Dias. And the film The Nose Show will screen on Monday, January the 13th at the View Cinema in Limerick at 6:30 as part of the First Fortnight Festival. firstfortnight.ie for more details there. And there'll be a discussion after the screening. And The Nose Show will be in Dublin as part of the Irish Film Institute's Spring Programme. Just before I go, don't forget, tomorrow night, would love to see you at the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan in North County Dublin. We will be there with our friends from Tradfest celebrating the life and career of Stephen Ray. We'll have music from Paddy Glacken, Neil Martin, Louise Mulcahy and the Lawler Sisters, and also with us on the night will be Sinead Cusack. Tradfest.com if you want to find out how to be there at that event. Of course, you can listen to us here tomorrow night as usual on RT Radio 1. But that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields was the researcher. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reggie Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, live from the Lark in Balbriggan, North County Dublin. And Fionn O'Brien, I do believe, will be with you after the news.